Hello and welcome to HealthCast. Wan Yu Huang, an assistant professor in the program in public health and the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University, was featured in an episode from C4E Presents, a podcast from Stony Brook's Collaborative for the Earth. In this episode, titled Garbage Air, Dr. Huang dives into the complex relationship between climate change and air pollution. Climate change has a significant impact on human health, causing a range of illnesses and oftentimes even exacerbating existing conditions. Here at Stony Brook Medicine, we are deeply committed to addressing climate change and working towards a more sustainable future. We are excited to share this conversation with you, and we hope you enjoy.
When smoke pours into our region from fires further north, we know the air quality is bad. But a lot of the pollutants that make air dangerous to breathe are not so obvious. Things like nitrous oxides and ozone released as byproducts of our love affair with the automobile. They might be odorless and colorless, but they poison the air nonetheless. And their concentrations depend on a complex interplay of our driving habits, the weather, natural topography, and the details of our built environment. The result is a highly unequal exposure to what our guest today calls garbage air, with a host of impacts on childhood asthma and other associated diseases. So, how do we map this garbage air? What effects is it having on public health? And what impact will New York's congestion pricing plan have? All of that and more coming up next.
Stony Brook's Study Abroad program welcomes you to apply for a full semester as well as summer and winter opportunities to explore and implement solutions to address our changing environment in countries like Madagascar, Tanzania, Jamaica, and elsewhere. Engaging with climate change will take a global effort, and you can start right here at Stony Brook. Visit stonybrook.edu/studyabroad.
This is C4E Presents, a podcast from Stony Brook's Collaborative for the Earth. I'm Heather Lynch. We're addressing a broad array of environmental problems that are being studied right here on Stony Brook University's campus. And we're having conversations with scholars, experts, and researchers who are concerned about the threats facing our planet, what it means for our world and local culture, and how we might seek solutions to these vexing problems. Joining me now is Guan Yu Huang, assistant professor in the Program in Public Health
and the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. As we'll get into today, Guan Yu works on air quality and climate change and what all this means for our health. Guan Yu, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me here.
I have to say that you have the absolutely most direct description of your research on your website, which is, and I quote, "Our goal is to prevent people from breathing garbage." I absolutely love that. So what kinds of garbage are you particularly focused on?
We focus on air pollutants like trace gases, NO2, and their PM2.5 or PM10, which literally particulate matters, aerosol, those small particles that are suspended in the air that are pretty harmful for people's health. That's pretty much things that we care.
So I know that you work on ozone. You just mentioned that. And when most people think of ozone, it's usually in the context of the ozone hole. But you're worried about ozone as a pollutant. So maybe you could explain what ozone actually is and why it's something we even need to be worried about in the context of air pollution.
That's actually a great question. So when we're talking about ozone, we're talking about like good ozone and a bad ozone. When people feel like their ozone, which is very critical issue, that actually happens in the stratosphere, which is literally more than 10 kilometers above Earth's surface. That ozone in the stratosphere, high above this year, actually protects us from the UV rate, from the harmful radiation from the sun. So that's very important. We want to make sure we have a good amount of ozone in that area in the stratosphere. That is what we call good ozone. But where ozone is very close to where we are, which is the troposphere, or we're talking the boundary layer where people are breathing, where people are living, and also our agriculture, food is produced, ozone, that's the bad ozone. We call it bad ozone. That's part of the air pollutant. That ozone we are breathing will actually hurt the lung and actually cause asthma issues and all these kind of diseases. Ozone actually can hurt agriculture production and reduce agriculture production, which also could cause some food security issues. That's why the ozone within the boundary layer where we are, that's actually caused a lot of problems. So that's why we care about that, we call it the bad ozone.
So what makes ozone? Like when we worry about breathing ozone, where is that ozone actually coming from?
That's a great question. So the ozone is not directly emitted from like factory manufacturers or cars. It is what we call the secondary air pollutant, which literally is produced by photochemical reactions. For example, from nitrogen dioxide, NO2, and which literally emitted from our combustions like cars or burning anything, and plus those carbon organics compounds like formaldehyde and those kind of chemicals. We call the VOCs, those VOCs plus NOx. And when we actually have sunlight, that actually makes ozone happens. That actually produces a lot of ozone. So that's why it makes the ozone is very complicated air pollutant to deal with, because we need to control both anthropogenic emissions, but also want to think about natural emissions to reduce the ozone level.
So we hear a lot about NOx. So what is NOx? NOx is short for our non-chemists.
NOx is actually NO plus NO2. So as when we were talking about like the car emissions and the NOx, they are actually a major air pollutant directly emitted from the cars.
And that would be, just for our listeners that don't know a lot about automobiles, that would be from gas-powered automobiles, but not from electric vehicles. Would that be correct? So electric vehicles are just putting out, I guess, water vapor as a byproduct?
Yeah, pretty much. Actually, NOx is actually coming from their gas, diesels, cars, trucks, especially for those heavy trucks. And therefore, their electric vehicles, they're actually pretty clean, literally just zero emission.
So I'm curious, and I don't know if you have any plans to do so, but certainly one of the big stories this year is the introduction of congestion pricing in New York City. And we would expect a sharp drop in the number of cars traveling in the lower Manhattan area. So I'm curious if you have any plans to study air pollution in lower Manhattan now that we have congestion pricing in effect.
That's a good question, because we have been talking about congestion fees. And one of their major benefits from the congestion fees is probably reduce the car numbers. And eventually, we're going to have a clean air. That's what we thought. We plan to, number one, measure it. We are actually building a mobile lab with some instruments for multiple air pollutants. We will deploy the mobile lab to drive around the New York area to see how their air pollutants looks like after their congestion fees. Now, number two, we're actually working with somebody from the United States Environmental Agency. We'll build a high-resolution air pollution model to see how the new congestion fees could reduce the car numbers and eventually how much cleaner it could be for our air.
So I'm just curious why a mobile lab as opposed to sort of fixed air pollution stations. I don't know how big this equipment is or if there's an advantage to actually having it on a truck that's sort of moving through the city.
We actually have many fixed sites to measure the air pollutants, which are very important. But, you know, as we know that those air pollution distributes varies over different time and different locations. We cannot cover everywhere, especially for some underserved communities, which are suffering from high-level health air pollutants and their lack of measurements. So with a mobile lab, which literally just are, you know, put some instruments in a van and drive around, that would be a big help for us to find how air pollution looks like, you know, between our fixed sites. That give us their, you know, spatial and their temporal resolution distribution of all different kind of air pollutants. So that actually help us to understand what's going on with the air that we are breathing.
So when do you hope to get the mobile lab in action down there in Lower Manhattan?
Hopefully within 1 year.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, I hope the congestion pricing is still underway then, because I know it's certainly controversial and, you know, we'll see if it continues. But by all reports, it seems to be reducing traffic by, you know, something like 6 or 8%. So that seems promising.
Right.
One of the things that you look at is not just air pollution, but the relationship between air pollution and climate change. And I'm wondering what the relationship is between those two things and which pollutants you expect to become more problematic from a public health perspective as the climate gets warmer?
That's a million-dollar question. We are still looking at it as we believe that the temperature goes higher and our weather pattern, meteorological conditions change. Literally, in general, all kinds of air pollutant issues are getting worse. So, like I said, we're talking about aerosols and what's happening, the fires happening in LA actually cause a lot of air pollutant issues. So, literally, everything about air pollution is probably going to worse under the changing climate. So that's why even the climate itself is actually a threat to health. For example, the high temperature, extreme temperature, heat waves, big threats to people's health. So to be honest, we don't know. We want to figure it out because it's a very important question for everybody.
So I know that you use a lot of remote sensing, and I'm curious, how do you use remote sensing? Because obviously we can't directly see these pollutants in the air, so you must be using some sort of proxy, I imagine, for pollution?
Yeah, that's what we call retrieval. Literally, we see the pollution from, some of the air pollutants can be seen from the satellite. For example, NO2, we actually have a pretty good observations over at least the tropospheric NO2. That actually help us understand what's going on with the surface. And also for ozone, we have a pretty good satellite observation on ozone as well. So I will also introduce you a new satellite sensor, which is called TEMPO. That's the latest technique that NASA has just launched 2 years ago, a little bit less than 2 years ago. It is the first generation of a geostationary satellite to monitor the air pollutant over the North America. That's geostationary means that satellite can provide hourly high-resolution observations over North America from New York to Los Angeles, from Mexico to Canada. So that satellite actually gives us a lot of information about air pollution and the forecast of air pollution, all the useful information. So that's how we use satellite to study air pollution.
And what's the spatial resolution of TEMPO?
The TEMPO's spatial resolution is roughly 2 to 4 kilometers. That actually can give us information, for example, when the air pollutant plume coming from New York goes all the way to Connecticut, we'll actually see a lot of, air pollutants originally from New York, and it goes to Long Island and Connecticut.
So I know that half of your appointment is in public health, and so you're very invested in sort of the applied public health elements of this, but I'm curious how this modeling that you're doing actually helps us on the ground. Like how do you see us using this air pollution, these forecasts, for example, to improve health outcomes?
Yeah, that's actually kind of like for everybody that who are doing air pollution studies, we all curious about health because all the, laws, regulations, and standards were set for air pollutants. It's all coming from the health, It's all coming from the health. So what my study is actually improve the exposure model to accurately describe how much air pollutants that people have been exposed and quantify those numbers. So that's how we actually can accurately describe that, for example, how much air pollutants that people or that group of people actually exposed to. And then to help us understand the impact of air pollutants on people's health. So that's kind of like my 50% part or some part of appointed to public health.
So in terms of trying to think about the relationship between air pollution and, say, lung cancer risk, I guess your models will allow us to understand, okay, what was the actual lifetime exposure of someone that was living at this address a certain amount of time?
Yeah, exactly. Especially when we're talking about cancer epidemiology, then we need a long time exposure model because the cancer does not happen like within a month or, a year. It's actually, we're talking about like 20 or 30 years exposure. So that's kind of like we increase the long term exposure model to help, doctors and epidemiologists to understand the relationship between cancer and air pollutants.
And so how much does air pollution vary from block to block? I don't have a sense for whether there are good streets and bad streets in New York City, and what would make a good street in terms of trees or building heights or something like that?
Unfortunately, yes. Air pollutants actually varies blocks by blocks, and sometimes actually can change a lot. It's a very strong gradient within blocks. So that's actually very sad issues that we are also working with, which what we called environmental justice. So, you know, we do have some good blocks. So sometimes the bad blocks can be, you know, one time or two times higher of some specific air pollutants than good blocks. And very unfortunately that we notice that disadvantaged communities or underserved communities actually expose higher or sometimes much higher air pollutant than other communities. So that's also a studies that we are working on. And that's also why we are building our mobile lab to capture those, you know, gradient, horizontal gradient, temporal gradients within communities. So that's why we actually work with communities a lot, help them to address this environmental justice issue.
And is that because of more car traffic or truck traffic in those lower income neighborhoods? Or what is responsible for that sort of environmental justice component to it?
Yeah, there are actually many reasons. Like you said, there's many cars and also kind of like interstates. Those very busy traffic actually go through those underserved communities. And also we have a lot of industrialized areas. And there are unfortunately many underserved communities actually close to those industrialized areas. And also we noticed it was because of their urban planning, and historical is also related to the redlining issues roughly 100 years ago. So it's kind of, you know, justice is also is related to the socioeconomic issue, and also it could be a race issue, all these kind of things. So it's very complicated. It actually depends on block by block, community by community. So yeah, I would say it's a local, and it's a national issue. We do see this kind of environmental justice issues, not only in New York, but also in pretty much all major urban areas in the states.
And like, how do trees play into this? Do we, as ecologists, we think a lot about the tree community in urban centers as being important for cooling the streets, but how does it, is it absorbing pollution? Is it releasing pollution?
That's another a million questions. So it really depends. So for example, in theory, sometimes the trees actually can reduce the pollution. But unfortunately, in some cases under a warming climate, and for example, the summer is getting hotter, the emissions from the trees actually can get higher, which literally causes worse air pollutants over that kind of communities. So that's why we have to work carefully with our partners and communities. We want to select the right trees for that community so we can reduce the heat exposure and also reduce air pollutants.
I see. That's interesting. So there are some trees that release more of these isoprenes than others. And so maybe selecting sort of low isoprene emitting trees, you know, in particularly in areas maybe that have poor airflow or where the air is settling. I can imagine there would be a temperature inversion where you might have a settling of colder air temperatures at night.
Yeah.
I hear a lot about AI and what it might offer in terms of climate modeling. So I'm wondering how you see AI playing into the kind of work that you do on air pollution. And are you currently using AI in any of these models?
Yes, we actually use AI. AI is actually a big help. And we, as we said, when we have so many observations, measurements, there's something we cannot get. So we actually use AI to help us to fill those gaps between measurements and the modeling. We don't use AI as a black box. We want to use it based on science, and we also validate those AI results. So that's why we use AI, but we use AI carefully.
I see. So in your case, you're using it to maybe interpolate locations and times where direct measurements weren't, sort of a data model integration gap there where AI can help fill in the gaps.
Right. And we also use AI to do some predictions.
And what is the prediction horizon for air quality? You know, we're used to thinking about a weather forecast as now they go out on your phone about to 10 days and they seem to be really good. Is the same true for air quality?
So in general, AI actually is promising and we got a really good result. But in some cases, we still work more on AI and see how AI can help us. And yes, AI is actually quite promising in your pollution field.
So if I see an air quality forecast going out about a week, I should trust it, AI or not, we can predict air quality out that far?
In general, yes. AI is actually doing a pretty good job in weeks of, you know, air pollution forecast.
That's very cool. Well, I know that certainly in my own field and in yours as well, a lot of people are interested in the changes that happened to the environment during the COVID lockdowns. So, you know, we would call that the anthropause. And I know that you've looked at the impact of the anthropause on air quality. So I'm kind of curious, what did you learn about, you know, the state of air quality and air production from studying that period where, you know, a lot of the world stayed home?
Yeah. So actually, COVID gave us a very unique opportunity to kind of like do a real world experiences that when we shut down everything, all the industry and especially the cars, and how does the air quality look like without cars? So we did actually see a huge reductions of some air pollutants, but we don't see many of them. As we know that the air pollution actually depends on complicated physical and chemical reactions and a lot going on. When we see the results from COVID, we still feel like it's a lot more needed to learn. Because in theory, we feel like, oh, we probably just shut down all the cars, we shut down all the factories, then we don't have any air pollution issues. And the real thing is, well, when COVID happened, when we reduced like 90% of the cars running on the road, pollutants are still there. You know, their greenhouse gas are still there. So that actually give us a lot of questions, what we could do, what we should do. Maybe just simply reduce some of the emissions may not be helpful. Or maybe we should do more than just simply reduce. So that's actually bring more questions to us.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because, you know, the answer to the question is, well, how do we improve air quality? You know, and you could say, well, we just need to stop driving. But COVID, as I understand it, showed us that that's probably not enough. So are there any easy solutions to improving our air quality?
Yes, of course. That actually, we just drive less. That helps quite a little bit. And we use more renewable energies. For example, the EV shows that their air pollution actually consistently getting better because of their electric vehicles numbers. We do see those differences between cities with higher electric vehicles. Their air pollution actually getting better than cities with lower electric vehicles numbers. So that actually definitely helps. And also their power plants, we use the renewable energy power plants that actually help. So in general, you know, reduce emissions definitely help, but probably we do need to do more. But for the people that it's just easy for us, let's take the public transportation, we drive less, we walk more, we bike more, that's definitely helpful.
And I think that's the challenge in some of these urban centers is that we are encouraging people to walk more, bike more, and yet it's a bit of a catch-22 chicken and egg problem, because until the air quality is better, particularly in other sort of megacities around the world, it's not particularly safe to be walking or biking, you know, rather than go in your enclosed car. So It certainly is a challenge for some cities to clean up the air enough that people feel comfortable biking, for example, to work.
Exactly.
So what do you think the future brings for your research? Like, what are you excited to be working on, and what do you see coming up over the next sort of 5 or 10 years that's really going to transform the way we model air pollution, how we fix air pollution, how we monitor it?
Yes. So regarding my research, I feel like there will be a stronger connection between the air pollution, climate change, and health. So as we know that when the climate is changing, it actually changes everything. There, like, the current knowledge about air pollution and health might be a little bit different before climate change happens. So that's what we are trying to do, is to find the quantitatively or mechanisms between the climate change and the air pollution, and then result and how they impacts the health. That's what we're doing. So, and also my lab is specifically interesting the environment justice, actually because environmental justice is an air pollution issue, but also a healthy, public health issue. So you want to work more with communities and underserved communities to help them with their climate, health, air pollution issues, but also to make sure they understand what's going on with their environmental justice issues under this, you know, changing climate. So that's why our mobile lab is not only to map those air pollutants, but also we'll use the mobile lab as a tour to do a lot of community engagement to let people know how the air is being measured, how your air is looks like, all this kind of questions.
Do you have a sense for how you might provide that information to the public? Like, will these maps be made available online? Like, how will communities find out about the air quality in their neighborhood?
Yes. So we will actually work with communities to make sure that, you know, distribute our information, and our maps will be online. We will make it very visualize those maps and make sure they're user friendly so people can easily get access to those maps. They don't have to check it every day. And we also want to work with community libraries, local schools to make sure our kids, children actually know what's going on with the air that they're breathing.
Yeah, and I can certainly imagine an era of sort of hyper-local alerts, you know, where you might have an elementary school where they're getting an alert like, okay, recess is inside today, you know, because air quality is poor on your playground, but, you know, a school maybe 2 or 3 blocks away, you know, would get information that, in fact, the kids can go out and play.
Right.
Well, we certainly have a lot of experts at Stony Brook University in risk communication and in data visualization. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for exciting collaboration here. But this mobile lab sounds super exciting. And I can't wait to see, you know, Seawolf and Blazoned Van sort of traveling up and down New York, and certainly the congestion pricing. Hopefully it will continue, because I think in addition to everything else, it's just a fabulous experiment in what reducing car traffic in a big urban center like that will do for air quality. And that was one of the major benefits of doing it. So it's a fantastic experiment, and I look forward to seeing what happens next. But I've learned so much about air quality, so I really thank you so much for being on the podcast.
All right. Thank you so very much.
That was Guanyu Huang, assistant professor in the program in public health and in the School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at Stony Brook University. To learn more about Guanyu's research, you can visit his webpage at aqhuang.weebly.com. I'm Heather Lynch. That's a wrap-up of another episode of C4E Presents. Our goal is to bring you closer to environmental issues with interviews from scholars, experts, and researchers from Stony Brook University, exploring and explaining the state of our planet and creating actionable solutions for climate change. In our next episode, we will be speaking to sustainability and coastal resilience expert Sarah Hamadeh about her work at the intersection of natural hazards, housing, and disaster recovery.